Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Here's What We Teach at the Law School right after this. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, it is regulated by the Welfare Department, the Department of Family Services, and the Family Court. And the best part about all of this is that you have no input into or say-so over the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of the above, and if you fail to pay, you go to jail. Now, marriage is the most important, and it's the most expensive contract that you can engage in. It is more binding, it is more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage. And you probably know a whole lot less about that obligation than your military obligation or your house payments. Now, about two-thirds of all marriages will end in divorce. But whether you're a husband or a wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or to defend against any breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you ought to know and understand the terms and conditions of your marriage contract before you marry. And you should be writing that contract instead of letting the state write it for you. So whether you're married or not, why don't you write for our free general law CD set and let me share some vital information with you about this law and the marriage contract. Just call us direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's an easy one to remember. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about what we teach here at the law school, and the last two schools that we teach are family law or family court and civil rights. Now, these two I put at the end of the program because they're kind of like electives. First of all, not everyone is interested in getting a divorce. They're not interested in child custody. And they're not interested in suing the police or some other public agency or official because of some wrong that's been connected or has been perpetrated against them. Now, as a result of that, though, although most people aren't, a lot of people do. A lot of people are arrested by the police or they're put upon by public agencies or officials, and they believe they have a wrong that needs to be righted. And two-thirds of us are going to end up in divorce court at some point in our lives. That's a bunch of people. Now, most people go through the divorce process and they just take it on the chin and shut up. They have their properties taken away from them. They have their children confiscated. Sometimes the state comes in, takes the children, puts them in foster care, and the parents never see them again. And we're asking questions. Why? Where did this power come from? Why does the state come in here and take children, about $2.5 million a year, out of their homes and put them in foster care? Where does the state get that kind of power anyway? So we'll take a look at that and we'll tell you the answer here. The state gets its power from the doctrine of Perrin's Patrae. Perrin's Patrae is what that's called. And the state's power comes from a contract that you made with the state. You, your spouse, and the state create this contract. It's called a marriage license. And a license is a contract. Now, when I say that to people, oftentimes somebody will jump up and say, "Oh, no, no, Mr. Gordon. Why, look at the definition of license in the law dictionary, and it tells you plainly it's not a contract." Well, I looked that up, and then I applied a little reason, logic, and common sense to it. Let's see what it is. A contract is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. There's four elements here to a contract. Now, a license is an offer from the state to you, and you accept it. And then you pay money called consideration. And then there's a time limit. See, there's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. Now, it is true that a license is a different kind of contract. I don't deny it. But it's a contract, like it or lump it. It's like an adhesion contract is a contract, but it's a different kind of contract than we would like to normally think in terms of contract and contract law. So when we take a look here at the power of the state, what is family court anyway? Well, the power of the state, in one paragraph, tells us four things. Listen to this. The state, as parens patrae, has a wide range of power for limiting parental freedom and authority in things affecting the child's welfare. How do you like that? And the parents as natural guardians are responsible to the state for the child's well-being. The natural rights of a parent to the custody and control of his infant child are subject to the power of the state and may be restricted and regulated by appropriate legislative or judicial action. Now I ask the question, well, where in the hell did the state get that power? Well, you gave it to them. Why did you do that? That's the real bottom line question. Why did you do that? Even God Almighty Himself does not claim ownership or power over your child. Doesn't claim that he's a third party in a three-party limited general partnership and doesn't impose any of this feudalism upon you in the construction of the statutes concerning marriage and divorce in the Bible. But the state does. Now, evidently, in your wisdom, you decided that God was wrong and that you and the state were right, and you entered into a contract. Now, I want to point out to you that in Leviticus 18, verses 3 through 5, you were told, don't do that. And then there's three other statutes. For instance, in Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33, you were told plainly, don't enter into contracts with foreign and alien gods. You were told plainly in the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. But then, you know, you and I are smarter than God, and so, you know, we have our take on it, and we went ahead and did it anyway. But it's not because we weren't told. So if you went out and got a marriage license, that's your decision. You did it. And you gave the state this power, and they're exercising their power through social lady and the police. And they just come up, knock on your door, take your kid, and that's the end of it. Then when you get divorced, you jump up and down, you rant and rave, and you paw the ground and bite the bushes, but all to no avail. Now, this power is based on the state's duty as parens patrae to protect those of its citizens, so citizenship is involved here, and are unable because of infancy to take care of themselves and on the right of the child as citizen and ward to its protection, as well as upon the state's interest in its own perpetuation. So where the parents become or because of their religious beliefs or for some other reason, if they fail to provide or refuse to permit medical treatment, for instance, which the child requires for its health or survival, the state may take custody from the parents in order to provide such treatment. And the court's power to interfere may include treatment for mental or emotional ills as well as purely physical ailments. So the state has broad powers, and the authority of the state through its legislature to restrict and regulate the parental power of custody and control over minor children covers a wide field of possible legislation, including such subjects as the education of the child or conditions of work and employment for children, the punishment and reformation of juvenile delinquents, and the substitution of others in place of the natural parents. They just take them and put them in foster care. And so people will knock on my door, they call me on the telephone, and they're oftentimes in tears, asking, what can I do to get my child back? And it's my job, my duty, my position in life to tell them there isn't anything you're going to do about it. It's already been done, past tense. See, once you have given your child away, the child is gone. Can you understand that? Once you sign the birth certificate under the terms and conditions of your marriage license, pursuant to your citizenship, and in violation of the laws of God, the child is gone, past tense, unrecoverable, period. End of report. Now, there are some things you can do to get custody of the child or to retain custody, but you must follow all of the state's rules and regulations and customs, usages, and practices. And that's all. That's what you agreed to when you gave the child to the state, and so that's what you're going to have to do if you want to be the custodial parent. That's the bottom line. Now, if you're not married yet and you say to yourself, well, gee, I'd like to have that child myself, I'd like to do that outside of the doctrine of parents patria. I'd like to do that under the laws of God, the Ten Commandment model. I'd like to stop practicing the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. Now you're talking. Now that's got some merit. Why don't you consider that before you give your child away? Why don't you and your wife keep the child? I know it's a wild new idea, but, you know, instead of giving them away, why don't you keep them? Now, I had 5 children, gave them all away. But then when the state came against me and they said, okay, here's what we're going to do, understanding that, I said, well, I don't have any children, I gave them away. I know they wanted me to pay child support, and I said, well, if I had any children, I'd pay. But I don't have any children, I gave them away. And so I didn't pay. Now, I don't see any reason why you should pay child support on a child that you gave to the state. Now, most people do that. It's not very logical. If you want to, you certainly can, but you don't have to if you don't want to. Now, there's a couple of other fallacies that come into play here that people have, and that is that this is my child. You know, they say, this is my car. This is my house. This is my child. Ladies and gentlemen, let me inform you, you don't own that house, as evidenced by the property tax that you're paying every year. Prima facie evidence that you're renting it from the state. The automobile, you have to register it every year. Prima facie evidence, you don't own it. Furthermore, there's a license plate on the front and the back of it. Prima facie evidence that it belongs to the state, just like a ship carrying a flag. It's the flagship of some country. It's not owned by some individual. And this child over here, prima facie evidence that it's not your child, is social lady's power to take the child out of your home and place it in foster care. And people are really concerned about that, and they're really worried, and they say, I better send my child to public school. Well, now there's 3 ways for you to educate your child. You can send him to public school. That's what the state wants. You can educate your child in parochial school. Or you can educate your child at home. Every state in the union makes provisions for that. Most people are ignorant, and they don't know how to apply the law in their individual case. And so they send their children to public school because they think it's the law. They have to. There's no other alternative. Vaccinations fall into that category. The census falls into that category. There's lots of laws out there that you don't have to follow if you could apply the law and claim the exemption or the exception. And that's what this school is all about. That's what we do here in the family law court or the family court school, is to educate people as to what their rights, duties, and obligations are. I'm not offering you my opinion. I'm just citing right from the law. This is the way it is. Now, let me give you a little history here on the doctrine of parens patria. It's an odd term. You know, you probably, if you're the average Joe Sixpack, you've never heard that word, parens patria. It's spelled P-A-R-E-N-S, and the second word is P-A-T-R-I-A-E, and fiduciary obligations and state power. Listen to this. The origin of this doctrine of parens patriae and the law can be traced to medieval and late medieval English chancery courts, where it played an important role in maintaining the structure of feudalism. So the doctrine of parens patriae being applied to your child today comes from feudalism. It's a feudal practice. It was necessary back in the Middle Ages, and it's necessary today. I don't deny that it's necessary. And it isn't good for you. It isn't good for your child. Probably isn't good for your wife. But, you know, you people have agreed to it, and you've signed up for it, and you're involved in it. And so you're stuck with it, like it or lump it. And if you want to know how to get the most mileage out of it, and you want to know how to put the least amount into it, and you want to keep control over your children, you want to be able to keep social lady at bay and the juvenile authorities away from your kid, then you've got to know what the laws are and how to apply them. That's all. Now, chancery, as an agent of the monarchy, had a duty to assure the orderly transfer of feudal duties from one generation to another, and to ensure that there would be someone available to perform these duties, and the concept of parens patriae was usually invoked in connection with problems of property and or guardianship. Well, this doctrine of parens patriae is being applied today. We don't call it that, but it's the same practice of feudalism today as it was back in the Middle Ages. And the state does this to perpetuate itself, so that the state doesn't die out. So there has to be, you're going to die, you're going to get old and die, and we have to have your children, your offspring, to take your place. And if we want the state to grow, well, then we have to have more children than are dying. And we have to have children for growth and children to replace those that are going to die. Now, an illustration of this is from my own experience here. My uncle Carol, after World War II, wanted to draw unemployment insurance, and so he had to travel from Willits, California to Ukiah, California, the county seat, in order to get his unemployment check. And so when we got there, there was a big sign on the face of the building, and it said, Unemployment Department. I was about 9 years old. It's about 1950. Now, unemployment department is a negative term, and later they upgraded that to the Department of Employment by about 1955. Department of Employment. Later, about 1960, they upgraded it a step further to Job Service. Now, in Washington State, there may be other states that do this, but I picked this up on Washington State. Here in the United States, they've upgraded it to its ultimate, its final, its actual title, let's see if I can think of the name here. It has to do with the use of a resource. It's the use of a resource, and it's called the Department of Human Resources. You people out there in Washington probably are familiar with that. The rest of us are still dealing with job service or Department of Employment, but out there you've got the ultimate. It's the Department of Human Resources. So I looked up resources in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, and it is a product. It's a product used in the manufacturing process and used up and consumed in the manufacturing process. That's labor. That's feudalism, and here's the way it works. You see, the 13th Amendment, going back to the Civil War now, abolished involuntary servitude. It abolished the bondservant statute of the Scripture. You see, the Creator of the universe put a series of statutes together at Mount Sinai, one of which deals with bond servitude. Another deals with involuntary servitude, we commonly call slavery. Well, in our wisdom, being smarter than God, right after the Civil War, well, actually, during the Civil War, we came to the conclusion that involuntary servitude, slavery, and bond servitude, voluntary slavery, was against public policy, and so we changed the law. We abolished the law of God, and we substituted our own law, the 13th Amendment. Now, as a result of that, there's been some changes made in the outcome that comes from that. So up in Washington State, the way it works is this. The Weyerhaeuser Company, a corporation owned by the state, wants to use some human resources to plant trees on their tree plantation. They're barred from owning slaves or bond servants, so they have to rent them from the owner. And the only entity that can own people in the United States of America is the state. And that's why we have birth certificates. It's the prima facie evidence of the state ownership of people. So if you want to know who owns you, it's your state owns you. And when you tell people that, they gasp and they look at you and say, oh, no, no, that can't be true. Well, okay. I don't care if you believe me or not. I'm not here to persuade you that I'm right and you're wrong. I'm not getting paid to persuade you one way or the other. I get paid to deliver information, and that's what I'm doing. I'm doing my job. I'm delivering the information. And so the Department of Human Resources sends you out to the Weyerhaeuser Company because you're looking for employment. You're not looking for property. You're looking for employment. And so you're now called an employee instead of a bondservant. And so you go to work for the Weyerhaeuser Company, and they put you to work on their plantation planting trees. But at some point in time, you're used up. Usually by about age 62 or 65, you get used up, and then as a result of that, you have to be pensioned off. Now, the state has to protect its feudalistic process by providing offspring or replacements for you, and that's why they want your children. And so they send you to their schools and educate you to get a birth certificate and a marriage license so that they can control the output from these family enterprises, because the children are the profit that is generated by this family. All right, so that's the way that game is played. And so here in chapter 9, I believe it is, yep, chapter 9, we have a chapter on the doctrine of parens patriae to show you how that works. In chapter 1, we show you where the state power comes from. Now, there's 48 things that you need to know about this. You know, such things as, what is family court? The guardian-ward relationship. Wickard versus Filburn. That's an interesting case, come from the Supreme Court, Wickard versus Filburn, where it tells us, and if you want to look this up, you can, it's 317 U.S. 111, Wickard versus Filburn. The Supreme Court tells us that it's hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. So government is anxious to subsidize your marriage with free education for all children in public school. And then the welfare and food stamps and all kinds of benefits for families. so that they can regulate and control you. You see, your Creator told you not to do that. Your Creator instructed you, gave you instruction, gave you law, said, don't do that. But, you know, for whatever reason, you decided, no, it's bad law and I don't want to do that. And so now the government comes in under Wickard versus Filburn and they snatch your kid, put him in a foster home, and then you're sitting there wondering, can they do that? Certainly. They do it every day, 2.5 million times a year. Adhesion contracts, the Communist Manifesto, the 14th Amendment, Hale versus Hinkle, status, parents patre, and 12 custody standards. Now, this is important. This is chapter 10, 12 custody standards, because oftentimes people will come to me and they'll say, well, my ex-wife is a dirty shrew and she doesn't deserve those children and I want to get custody. And we can do that. 97% of the time, the custody will be awarded to the mother, the female. That's under the new law. That's the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Under the 10 commandment model, 100% of the time, the child is awarded to the father. So you can see why women prefer the marriage license and the Roman civil law over the Ten Commandments. Very important reason why. Women have a bonding process. They actually have juices that run around in their bodies called hormones. And they bond to their child. Men don't. So out in nature, you see this all the time. If you see a boar bear, and then he's got a couple of cubs in the neighborhood, he runs over, kills the cubs, and eats them. If you have a sow bear, that's the mother bear, and she has a couple of cubs running around, she will fight to the death to protect the lives of those two cubs. And you'll find that in human beings also. Women do that. There was a classic case of a woman that in West Virginia ran off the road and into a creek. And she took her baby and pushed her baby up into the air pocket in the car, in the roof of the car. And by the time the rescue workers got down there, the woman was dead. But her body was wedged up in such a position that she'd pushed the child up into the air pocket, and she was holding the child up into the air pocket, and she was dead. Only a woman would do that. There was a woman in Mexico City in an earthquake where the ground actually opened up and she was filmed and she fell into the hole, the crack in the earth, with her baby. And in just before the earth closed up on her, she took her baby and flung it out of the hole up onto the ground, you know, up above her. And then the ground closed up and, of course, she was killed. Now, a woman, you see, will do that, but a man would take the baby and step on it to get out of the hole, but not a woman, see? And that's important in this whole process over here, because when God designed this marriage process, he gave the child to the father, not to the mother. Isn't that special? And that's because the mother bonds to the child, and so the mother will not leave this family if she has to leave her child behind. And under the Ten Commandment model, you women, you have to leave your child behind. It stays there with the father, see? And that's why we have this change. That's why we've adopted the Roman civil law. It's women that want it, not men. And so we just went along with you ladies. Well, now the state comes in, and the state now has ownership of the child. So now you just take the child away from both the boy and the girl. So for men, it's very difficult to get custody. Now there's a new modern practice. Women are now sharing their children with their husbands 50% of the time. It's kind of like a 50-50 child custody program. But there's a 12-part standard here that the courts follow. And if you knew what that 12-part standard was, you men out there, you'd have a much better opportunity in getting the child away from the mother and you getting custody of the child. It's not super common, but it's not uncommon either. And my wife has done 17 of those cases and taken custody away from the female and helped a man receive or to take custody of the child. See, that custody issue comes up every 12 months, once a year, every year. If you didn't know that, now you do. And if you could show that the female is in violation of one or more of those custody standards over there, you got a shot at taking the kid away from her. How's that for a plan? So that's the story on this family court. 48 things that you need to know. That deals with all kinds of real practical things like a prenuptial contractual agreement prior to marriage and a patriarchal marriage in place of a marriage license or a civil law marriage. You know, it's just kind of wild concepts like that. So let me fold this up, and I'm going to cover another one here, the last one here, which deals with civil rights. And where there's a wrong, there has to be a remedy. A remedy. That's what we call it in law. A remedy, a right. We're going to right this wrong by putting in a remedy. And it's called the Civil Rights Act of 1868, and we'll talk about that when we come back right after this reminder that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing or recommending will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. But if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the 8 schools here at the law school and what we teach. And so a lot of times people will call here and they say, well, I'd like to know more about that. And you tell me a little more about it. And you can do that. Just call us here at the law school and we'll tell you more about it. But I thought I'd run this one by you, these 8 schools, so that we give you a little more information about what we do and why we do it. Now, civil rights actions are also known as Title 42 suits. It comes under the Civil Rights Act of 1868, and it was designed for black people, primarily for black people, to recover damages against public officials who had wronged them, who had taken away a civil or constitutional right. And so a question arises, well, if it's good for black people, is it good for white people and Asians and Indians and American Indians and so on? And the answer is, you bet. You bet it is. So let me give you a couple, three illustrations here. So there's 41 things here that you need to know. And oftentimes people will say to me, well, of these 41 things that you need to know, is this your opinion? And the answer is no. No, we don't teach opinion here at the law school. Opinion belongs in philosophy. But in law, we have absolutes. And these absolutes are founded upon what we call rules or laws. They're also known as laws, customs, usages, and practices. And they don't have anything to do with my opinion. As a reporter, I have opinions. I don't deny that. But as an educator and as a legal instructor, we don't have opinions. We just report, this is the way the law works. This is the law. It's like I just reported to you. I said, no woman on planet Earth has ever owned a child. And when I make that statement, people gasp. And I'm going to say it again. On this planet, planet Earth, in the entire history of mankind from the Garden of Eden to today, no woman on this planet has ever owned her child. Nor will any woman on this planet in the future ever own a child. It ain't possible. It is possible for a man to own a child, but it's not possible for a woman to own a child, and none has ever been in the past, isn't now, and isn't going to be in the future. State won't stand for it. So if you think that your government, if you think marching on Washington is going to get you ownership of your children, ladies, you got another guess coming. They needed to get you to side with them to take ownership and custody of children away from your husband. And so they got two of you against him, and you've succeeded in taking the children away from the man. God never claimed to own them to start with. Isn't that strange? The creator of the universe never claimed to own those children. The state does. And so when there's a wrong and you think you've been wronged by the state and the state's action, the first thing people say, I want to sue the state. And then they want to bring a civil rights action because the state has taken my child. The state has not taken your child. None of you people out there own a child. The state owns the child. You're the babysitter for the state. And so when the state takes the child, all they're doing is changing babysitters. So you gave that child away by passing your seed through the fire to Moloch in violation of Leviticus 21 through 5. Now, you're told not to do that, but you did it anyway. So the first thing in a civil rights scenario is do you have a claim? Do you have an action? Have you been damaged? In most cases, the answer is no. For you people out there with social security numbers, driver's licenses, and marriage licenses, and business licenses, and the policeman arrested you, social lady took your kid, raped, robbed, and pillaged you, hell, you did that with their consent. You were all involved in a contractual agreement here. So they're not violating your rights. Now, occasionally, though, that does happen. Your rights are violated. And there was a case here not too long ago where I had a school teacher down in Miami, Florida. He collected $306,000 for a breach of contract suit against the school board for violating his rights, violating actually the terms and conditions of his contract. It was a long, protracted, complex, and drawn-out suit that the man did himself pro se, and he collected $306,000. Now, people will ask me oftentimes, how long, how many man hours, how much time, effort, and energy goes into one of these suits? And the answer is about 40 hours. Although in this case I'm describing to you, he probably spent 80. But for $306,000, just, you know, if you put out $306,000, you'd be making, or I mean, if you won $300,000 for 80 hours, you'd be making $3,800 an hour. Lawyers get paid about $150 to $250 an hour. The school teacher got $3,825 an hour for his time that he put in on his case. And he was entitled to get paid that money because that's what they had agreed to pay him. And then they acted in bad faith on top of it. Here's a second case. I have a student that just won $35,000. I think he spent about in the neighborhood of 40 hours on the case. It's been in litigation for about 16 months. And at that rate, he got paid $875 an hour for spending that 40 hours to get the damages that he was seeking for the violation of his rights. It had to do, the fellow was a druggist, and he took a job at an Army base, and the Army then, after he took the job, said to him, "You have to be vaccinated." And he said, "Well, because of my religious beliefs, I don't want to be vaccinated. I don't believe in vaccination." And it was an Army policy either. And so they fired him. And so then he sued the Army, and he sued the company that had hired him there for that job. And then he settled with them in an out-of-court settlement. And I personally thought it was worth a little more than that, but he said to me, I was talking on the telephone, he said, "Well, that's how much I think it's worth, and that's how much I want it." Now, that's what counts. Did you get what you thought that was worth? Do you believe that the compensation that you're receiving is adequate for the damage that you have suffered? And if the answer to that is yes, well, then that's enough money, even if you could have gotten more. I settled a case one time in which, in retrospect, I could have gotten probably several times more money. But when I settled my case out of court, I dictated the terms. I said, "Here's what I want." And they said, "Okay, we'll pay it." That's what told me. I didn't ask for enough. But that's what I wanted. That's what I thought was sufficient. And they paid me. Now, I'll tell you another story over here about a fella. And he was in Deming, New Mexico. And he wanted to change a law down there. See, they had a law that required that you identify yourself to the policeman. And so he strapped on a gun, .45, and he walked down Main Street, and the policeman saw him packing heat. And so he stopped to ask him some questions, like, "Who are you and where are you from?" And he said, "Kiss off, I ain't telling you." And so they arrested him, took him to jail, and he bailed out right away. But he ultimately settled for what we call a nuisance value claim, $10,000, upon condition that they would take that law off of the city books, the city ordinance, which they did. But even at that, he got paid $250 an hour for the amount of time that he spent on the lawsuit. And I think that's pretty significant. Now, the case that really... requires or really deserves some attention is a black fella by the name of Lawson. And Mr. Lawson believed that he was being put upon by the police officers of San Diego, California. Now, he's a black man. He had been arrested 11 times prior to this last time that he finally got paid. But he'd been arrested 11 times, and the police were arresting him, I don't know what for. I don't know, loitering or vagrancy or whatever it was. But each time he'd be acquitted, or sometimes I guess he'd be convicted. And so he decided that he needed to take action. So he didn't go to law school. He trained himself in law. Big difference here. See, normally they want to send you to law school for 5 years. And people oftentimes ask me, how can you train somebody in a facet or a part of law like civil rights and do it in a week, 30 hours? And it's an old adage that we used to use here in America. If you can't learn a craft or a trade in a week, you're probably not cut out for that. And so they'd put you out here with a guy. Let's say you wanted to be a plumber or you wanted to be a butcher. So what they do is they just put you right in the butcher shop. Stick a knife in your hand and throw a piece of meat on the table, and somebody will cut a piece off and say, "Just keep doing that." And then you just keep practicing, and then you keep practicing, and you just keep making the cuts. And pretty soon, you know, you're just making stew meat. But then as time progresses along, then they'll show you how to use the saw and how to make Kansas City cuts and how to make T-bone steaks and rib steaks and loin eyes and, you know. Now, how long does it take to train a butcher? Well, about a week. About a week. How long does it take to train a plumber? About a week. Electrician, about a week. I know a lot of you guys are sitting there, my God, I spent 4 years learning my craft. No, I didn't either. You learned it in about a week. And then you spent 4 years dicking around trying to show everybody you know that you were learning something. And they put you through a process that took 4 years. But that isn't how long it took you to learn how to do that. And the same thing is true here with law. Now, there's 15 professions. And you can learn law, a facet of law, not all of it. I remember Oliver Wendell Holmes was asked, how much law do you know, by one of his clerks? And he said, I don't know very much law, but I'm god awful good at the little bit that I do know. And I don't know everything there is about law either, but I'm god awful good at the, you know, 4 or 5 items that I do know. And we teach 8 schools here, 8 subject matters of law, and we're pretty good at the, you know, the limited amount that we teach here. And some of our schools, 2 of them, require 2 weeks. They're a little tougher. They're a little more complex. A little harder. You got to work a little harder. Takes 2 weeks to learn. Courtroom strategy and procedures. 28 things you need to know. And then the Mosaic Law. 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. Take you about 2 weeks to learn that one. All right, and then there's 90 common doctrines. That takes you about a week to learn that. But, you know, if you're average, you're not suffering from some learning disability or something like that. You're just an average run-of-the-mill person, and you just walk in the door and you sit down over here, and, you know, you can read and write. You know, you're literate. I can teach you how this civil rights thing works in about 30 hours. 41 things you need to know. Now, let me tell you about this guy, Lawson. Lawson trained himself in law. He's a self-trained pro se litigant. And here's what he did. He collected $130,000 from the San Diego Police Department in a case called Lawson versus Colander. Lawson versus Colander. I don't have the number here for you, but it's 1985, and it's a U.S. Supreme Court case. All right, so You can go look that one up, do a little research there. And what Mr. Lawson did was, in order to test his skill and ability, he went into his living room at 2 o'clock in the morning and picked up a television set. Then he went out to the front sidewalk at 2 o'clock in the morning, San Diego, California, and he starts walking up and down in front of his house. He didn't go anywhere; just walking up and down in front of his house. At 2 o'clock in the morning on the sidewalk, carrying his television set out of his living room. He's not harming anybody. He's not breaking any laws. He's just doing his thing, carrying his TV up and down in front of his house. You might try that. Try it, first of all, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Just go into your living room and get your television set and walk out on the sidewalk and just carry your television set up and down in front of your house. Okay, now try it at 2 o'clock in the morning. Ranger Rick is on patrol, and he comes by. He sees this black guy. I don't know what he would have done if the guy would have been white or Indian or something else, but the guy happened to be black, carrying his television in front of his house. And Ranger Rick stopped, and then he asked this guy what his name was, and Mr. Lawson told him to take a fly on you-know-what at the moon. Step back on his lawn. And the policeman now went ballistic. His adrenaline started to flow. He got excited. He arrested Lawson, hauled him off to jail. And the case wound its way through the litigation process to the U.S. Supreme Court, who came up with a decision that Mr. Lawson was right, the policeman was wrong. And as a result of that, the city of San Diego had to pay Mr. Lawson $130,000. Now, if Mr. Lawson spent as much time working on his case as I've worked on mine, 40 hours or so, he got paid pretty well for that, didn't he? He got paid several hundred dollars an hour for the amount of time that took. But it's more important than that. The police don't arrest Mr. Lawson anymore. They don't harass him or bother him anymore. That's the real payoff. Now, there was another black guy down in Houston, Texas, and he was jogging in the wee hours of the morning. It was dark at 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, a black man jogging at 5 o'clock in the morning is subject to police scrutiny. And so, two policemen riding in a patrol car driving down the street, and they saw this black guy. So they stopped, and they made inquiry, and they said, "Hey, Mr. Black Man, who are you, and where are you from?" And produce some identification. And these uppity blacks, you know them, and he said, although I don't know exactly what he said, but in effect he said, "Go take a flying you-know-what at the moon." And so, the policemen, they got excited. You know, they do that right away. Two white cops, they got real excited and arrested this guy. I don't know if they beat him up or not, but come to find out, this black guy in Houston was a federal judge. Yeah, he was a federal judge out jogging early in the morning. Now, this black federal judge didn't think that he needed to identify himself to the police at 5 o'clock in the morning. Isn't that crazy? Although most people out there listening to me right now would say, well, yeah, you know, when the police ask you for identification, you need to present it. Mr. Lawson didn't think that was so, and this black judge didn't think that was so either. And the black judge also took a settlement, although I don't know what his settlement was. I don't know how much money he settled for, but I would imagine it was something like $130,000, or typically they run around $300,000. If you want to know what these cases are worth when they go to litigation, $300,000, if they're settled out of court. If you're trained in negotiation, there's a book called Winkey on the Art of Negotiation. And you should be familiar with negotiating settlements, you know, when you get up to the civil rights portion, so that you settle your case and you get what you're entitled to. You know, you should get somewhere near what your claim is. All right, now that's the purpose behind that. Now, let me tell you about a wrong that was committed in Chicago. I mean a big wrong. And there was a doctor collected $112,000 in a strip search. And this doctor, the $112,000 award to a 38-year-old doctor who was strip searched by the Chicago police in January of 1978, is the largest of 11 verdicts that arose from a 1979 class action against the city, with 25 more cases still to be tried in federal court. All right, now that's the gist of the story. This policy of the Chicago police was this. The policeman was instructed when he's out on patrol, when you see a woman driving in a car by herself, a lone woman in a car, get behind her and stay right on her and dog her like a bird dog, and she'll make a mistake. She'll get nervous. And she'll change lanes without signaling, or she'll run a stop sign, or she'll do something that'll give you probable cause to stop her. Then go ahead and stop her and then check out all of her papers. And you check her license and registration and her insurance and her inspection sticker. And then you got an opportunity to look in the car. Maybe you'll find cocaine or some contraband lying on the seat. Or you'll find that maybe her baby isn't in a child restraint, isn't in his child seat or something like that. Then you've got a crime. Then you've got something to charge her with. See? Not that single women driving down the street by themselves are necessarily all criminals, but they were told that if you do this, about every five times you do that, you'll find a charge that you can lay to this woman, and no woman will spend a minute in jail if she can bail out. And so, at the very least, they get an interest-free loan from the bail money. And at best, she forfeits the bail money when she pleads guilty and pays the fine. And the Chicago police, I don't know about other police departments, but I had a Chicago policeman down here at school recently, and he said that they're instructed now, as I speak, that the policeman is supposed to make enough money in tickets on every shift to pay his salary, pay his wages. So the policemen, all the police in Chicago, are revenue agents working for the city of Chicago to generate enough money to pay their salaries. That's what they're there for. So when the policeman stops you and gives you a ticket, it's nothing personal. He's just trying to make his wages, that's all. He's not there to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. He's there to get his wages. Well, now, the federal courts came to the conclusion that this was a civil rights violation. And one judge said that there were 500,000 of those crimes committed against Chicago women between 1959 and 1979. In that 20-year period, you ladies in Chicago were victimized 500,000 times. That was 500,000 crimes committed by the Chicago Police Department against single women, not that you were unmarried, but just driving in your car by yourself. Now, if you were with your husband or with another woman, they wouldn't do this to you. Just if you're by yourself or you're just in the car with your baby or something like that, but not with another adult in the car. How do you like that policy? That's a crime. Now, let me tell you how many crimes are being committed here in the United States against us. The Supreme Court, in a case called Miranda versus Arizona, back in 1964, estimated that there were 40,000 police agencies in the United States, 40,000 police departments. They estimated that each one of those police departments perpetrated one civil rights violation against a citizen every day of the year. That's 365 in every police department. That's 365 times 40,000 is 14,600,000 crimes committed by the police. Now that's bare minimum. It's probably 2, 3, 4, 5 times greater than that, because big police departments like Los Angeles and San Diego are committing dozens a day, whereas a little police department like Gainesville, Missouri, maybe they're only doing one a week. But on average, they thought that it was more like about one a day for out of 40,000 police departments. That's 14,600,000 crimes. That's committed by the police against us. Now, but get this. The FBI, they keep accurate crime statistics, and they estimate that it's about 14 million crimes that are being committed against us every year by real criminals. See, the police aren't real criminals. They're just pretend criminals. They're just criminals that want to be criminals, but they're not quite there yet. So we're victimized, that's you and me, 600,000 times more by the police than we are by real criminals. So I came to the conclusion, if we would eliminate all of the police departments in America, we could cut the crime rate by more than half. Isn't that just special? Then, of course, the police say, oh, my God, if we did that, then the real criminals would come out and victimize you 10 times more than they're victimizing you now. Well, not with the Second Amendment in place, it wouldn't. I mean, as long as we're disarmed, that's probably true, but I don't believe that's true where people are armed. But, you know, I'll leave it up to you. You can decide for yourself. I'm just a reporter. I'm just here to tell you that there's a remedy for these wrongs. And the first thing we have to do is to determine whether or not you've actually got a wrong. Have you been damaged? And oftentimes the answer to that is no, you have not been damaged. And so therefore you don't have an action. But we have a thing called a sting. So if you'd like to learn how to do a sting like the FBI, see, they have a division in their department, the FBI, they have a division in which they go out and they send agents out to sting judges and policemen and public officials to see if they'll take a bribe. You know, like Governor Blagojevich. Could we sell a Senate seat? That's the way they do that. And when they can catch the governor or some policeman or some public official taking a bribe or arresting people or violating their rights like Lawson or like this doctor in Chicago, then they act. You know, you can do the same thing. I know it's kind of wild, but you, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, can also be undercover civil rights investigators. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed on our webpage. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.